The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, Philadelphia. Pete and I were already having a good time backstage. We were already starting to get into it. So we'll just pull everybody in. My understanding is Buttigieg. Would you like to tell everybody your name to get started, Mayor Pete?
That's right. Buttigieg. Rolls off the tongue, right?
I didn't say it like that.
It is. I don't know. It might be a Laurel Yanni thing. People hear different things. But back home, they just call me Mayor Pete. The thing I have going for me is elections are multiple choice, so you don't have to be able to say it or spell it. You just have to be able to pick me out of a lineup.
Well, maybe you should get my six-year-old to go. Pete the Cat is his favorite character. He would say, let's vote for Pete.
I was at an event recently, and a parent said that her four-year-old was going to leave in protest because I was not Pete the Cat. I was lesser of the Petes that was on offer. She was deeply disappointed.
Just my idea, you should give out buttons because Pete the Cat loses his buttons. At any rate, one of the questions that you are inevitably getting at the start of this moment is why now? You've got a trajectory that's going well, you could get in later, yet one of the stories you tell from the book, or David Axelrod says in the book, or maybe one of the many stories I read about you, is one of the things he told you, that he told Obama, is one of the key things that people sometimes miss is waiting too late to get in. Did that figure into your thinking?
Yeah, I think there is a discernment process you got to go through to contemplate running for any office. And to me, it's not about, I just don't think you should run for an office because you'd like to have it. And I think sometimes that happens, this idea. People are like, why don't you run for Congress? Well, I don't want to be in Congress. That's not what I want to do. I get the audacity of talking about national office as a mayor in his 30s. Of course, I understand that. But I believe the process goes like this. You look at an office. You look at a constituency. You look at what it needs in that moment. And then you think about what you bring to the table. And if and only if you think there might be a match, then you go for it. And that is a process that has led me to run for several offices, and it's a process that's led me to decide not to run for several offices. But I think it's much less about how a person plots their trajectory to the White House. It might be that this is the only moment in my life and in American history when it makes any sense to even think about this. But that moment would seem to be right now. This moment when my party has struggled to connect with the interior of the country and the industrial Midwest. This moment when three out of our last four presidents were born within a few weeks of each other in 1946, and there seems to be a great level of eagerness for generational change. This moment when the city, the local level, maybe the last really well-functioning, at least in our best-run cities and towns, the last well-functioning level of American government we have left. That just might call for a millennial Midwestern mayor to get into this conversation.
You're not the only mayor. Julian Castro's in. Mitch Landrieu may get in. Others might get in. You're not the only 30-something. Mm-hmm. Tulsi Gabbard is in. What distinguishes you? What is your story that you say, I'm not like the others?
I am the only left-handed millennial Episcopalian war veteran mayor, Maltese American in this, and I think I got that one going for
me. Okay, you win.
My theory of the case is that your profile, something unusual about somebody's profile, gets you a look. And it definitely rates a look that my profile is not like the others. There are some other veterans, but not executives. There are some other executives, but generally not from the Midwest. There are some other Midwesterners, but maybe not generational candidates, and so on. It's not even going to be lanes. There's 20 people in this. It's more like a Venn diagram. But the profile gets you a look. What really matters then is what do you have to say? What's the message? What's your substance? And then I actually believe there will be a third process when people get a first look because of their profile, and then they stay in the mix past the flavor of the month period because of their message. When a lot of the messages may actually largely converge, when we'll come down to messenger. So who is best positioned by dint of just your style or your vocabulary or something about how you do what you do to deliver that message for our party? And that's who I think the nominee is and ought to be.
part of delivering the right message is figuring out who you're talking to. Mm-hmm. You're a data guy. You just brought up a Venn diagram. It is hard to figure out, when you look at the landscape, which of the data points would you pick out? On one hand, you have millennials, but today we have a guy saying he thinks the Klan is the best answer to cleaning up Washington. How do you figure out the data points that you pull out as to who should be the people you speak to with the message?
Well, I believe politics is a process of assembling a coalition as broadly as you can. And I think one temptation, especially when we got just good enough ad data to do things like micro-targeting, one temptation that befell my party in particular was to slice everybody up into these little groups. And we had one message for this constituency and one message for that one. And one thing you learn very quickly as a mayor is you never want to say something to one group that you would be embarrassed to have repeated to another. And so it compels you to think about how you craft a message that matters broadly. So, for example, in my view, some of our same commitments around the topic of fairness that explain our economic message in industrial Midwestern blue-collar communities like mine are also the same commitments to fairness that explain the bedrock commitment to racial and social justice that animates much of the moral authority of our party. And it's not a matter of having one message for one group and one for another. It's thinking about things that will resonate in a true way in the lived experience of very different people so that they begin to see things they have in common with one another.
I'm stuck on this because in a day-to-day way, what we see and how we live is very different. Hmm. The person who chooses MSNBC versus the person who chooses Fox is choosing to stay in a tunnel that is very different. Yeah. You can say the same thing to those two groups of people. They will receive them differently. Hmm. How do you win over the person who may not naturally agree with you?
Well, my experience in South Bend, and we attracted a lot of conservative and independent support in South Bend, was never to do it by pretending to be more conservative than you are. I actually think it's no longer true. I think it's more true than ever that you got to appeal to independents. Hmm. It's less true than ever that appealing to independents has to do with ideological centrism. Think how many people narrowed down their choices to Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Think about how we got a president who basically doesn't even have an ideology. He has maybe a style, and that's about it. So what that tells me is it's not so much about trying to fit on somebody's idea of the left-to-right spectrum. Obviously, you explain what your values are, and you come down on policy controversies, and people can take your measure based on that. But I also think it's about telling a story that's going to make sense to people in their lived experience. So in South Bend, it is concrete, literally, right? One advantage you have in local government, there's not a lot of alternative facts in the sense that if there is a hole in the road, I can't do a Trumpian, I can't say there's no hole in the road, it's the best road ever in the history of roads. Because people say, no, there's a hole there, and you didn't fill it there. And so they'll call you out. Part of my project, part of why I'm trying to take a local government attitude and convey it into a national political environment, is to take that same reality-based character to the way we talk about potholes and bring it to the way we talk about things like healthcare. And I think if we do that, we will stand a better chance of being convincing to people across some of their different tribal or regional or ideological camps.
The book is largely about how you went back home and took a community that was struggling and pushed it forward and managed to bring it together. I wanted to talk about how you did that and how you take the message out. And I remember being a campaign reporter and people saying to me, if one more person asked me to go through retraining, I'm going to scream.
Yes.
I've spent 30 years, 40 years being who I am. I don't want to be anybody else. As I read your book, I thought a slogan was, it's not the past, it's the future. Hmm. So how do you do that with people whose lives have been about a certain past?
Yeah, it was a very challenging thing because, and it's worth a little bit of groundwork in describing South Bend if you haven't been there, because people know Notre Dame is in South Bend. Oh, technically it's outside city limits, but you know Notre Dame. So you might envision a tidy, wealthy, homogenous college town. We are a low-income, racially diverse industry town with colleges in it. We're just now celebrating that our per capita income has gone over $20,000. We were a company town for Studebaker. Studebaker was among the biggest auto companies until it came crashing to a halt in 1963. And even though it was some 40 years later, when I was first looking at running for mayor, you'd still hear some of the talk, the old timers would be talking about how, you know, we got to get something like Studebaker back. And the politically right thing to do probably was to convince them that you could do that, that with, for example, some massive incentive, you might be able to land the big factory that'll be the next Studebaker. And I felt that we had to have an honest conversation about the fact that nothing resembling that was ever going to come, that that's not coming back, but we are, and here's how. And we told a different story about how our city could thrive. But it took some brutal honesty, and I wasn't sure whether that honesty would be rewarded. In many ways, I think it may be generational in the sense that if I had lived to see the heyday, I probably would have thought of nothing else but restoring it, even though that was impossible. But because I grew up only among its fragments, the shuttered factories, the vacant houses, all I could think about was how to turn that into something new. And that was the project we undertook as a community and began growing again. But it wasn't, you know, make South Bend great again. And I believe that you cannot have an honest politics that revolves around the word again. It wasn't about rejecting the past either. I mean, we built on elements that we had in our past. It was facing the fact that the future was going to be different. Now, you've hit on something else I think very important politically, which is that there are a lot of well-intentioned retraining programs, mostly from my party, some of which are good, by the way. I mean, we run some in South Bend, but they miss something really important, which is that a job is a lot more than an income. And when you're disrupted from your job, when you've been a machinist for 20 years, and we tell you, guess what, we got you all figured out, go through our retraining program, and you're going to be a nurse's aide, which is no less worthy of a job, but it's not how you see yourself, then you didn't just lose your job. Maybe we fixed your income problem, but we didn't fix your identity problem. Jobs are a source of community, purpose, and identity. And as we enter this machine age where automation and artificial intelligence are only going to accelerate the number of changes any one worker has to go through, by the way, white collar as well as blue collar, and put us into a world where people my age and younger will change careers more often than people my parents' age and older change titles. That means that we have to offer some different accounts of what's going to fill that void of community, identity, and purpose. And there are some very ugly answers of tribalism and some very ugly forms of nationalism and what I can only describe as white identity politics that offer to fill in that void. Or you can fill that void with things like community, with things like faith and family, and some answers, some of which I may sound conservative talking about. But the point is looking to other places for identity, I think, is a very important function, not just politically, but socially, that mayors in particular ought to be paying attention to now.
So how did you get the 47, 52, 63-year-old to feel like they had a place in the new South Bend?
Well, part of it was to enlist people in the recovery of the community itself as its own project. So this is a thing that's going on really across the industrial Midwest. It's kind of a counterculture thing. But it's the idea that even as your jobs come and go, I mean, we need to fix the job issue so everybody has an income. I don't mean to minimize that. But as jobs come and go, you can draw a purpose from being part of the life of the community. And so people who, I don't even know what they do for a living other than that they must do something, but I know exactly where they fit in. Yeah, the guy who rebuilt the old rose garden in a park that had just been neglected for decades just because he cared about it. Young guy who set up an Instagram page on of kind of interesting images of Rust Belt decay but in a beautiful way and then used it as a touch point to talk about our city's comeback. A woman who created a lecture series on the future of the city. They have this identity that's rooted in the existence of the city itself. So that was part of it. Part of it, a little more mechanically, is just making sure we do, in fact, have good job opportunities that have dignity and that are compelling. And that's where we've had to, first of all, think about what advanced manufacturing looks like and honor the place that that has in our community, but also recognize that we got to keep creating jobs industries that did not exist in the Studebaker days, like data analytics and data services, some of which create secondary jobs that you don't have to be a 21-year-old computer science whiz to have a crack at.
In the book, when you talk about your first race, something surprising comes out. Of course, everybody notices how young you are. When they go to canvas older voters, they don't know a lot about you, but they like the fact you're young. They actually pick that as a reason to vote for you.
Yeah.
And what did that tell you about what was going on with them and what might be going on in this race for you?
Well, I don't think I'd be getting very far if it weren't for the generational energy, the excitement about this message I take out about how, you know, the generation, the school shooting generation, the generation that provided most of the troops after 9/11, the generation that's going to be dealing with climate change the rest of our lives needs to come to the table. I think one of the reasons that it is powerful is because there's another generation, my parents' generation, that really cares about making sure that the world is handed on in better shape. And as somebody who studied the late 60s, when the generational energy was about conflict, right? You studied the marches of 1968, and it was young people protesting against their parents. One of the things that amazed me when I went to things like the Women's March that we had in South Bend, or the March for Our Lives, which was organized by high schoolers, was that it wasn't them fighting their parents and grandparents. Often their parents and grandparents were standing right next to them cheering them on. And so I think part of the generational power of this moment is the possibility of establishing a generational alliance, not against one generation, but between generations against people like those in power who really are governing as though the problems they're creating are somebody else's problem. Right? The president literally said, I think it was about a fiscal issue that was a bit of a time bomb with the tax cuts. He said, I won't be here. Not my problem. But you don't have to be young to care about what the world's going to look like in 2054, which is the year that I get to the current age of the current president.
Little shade there. I like it. I wanted to talk to you about one factor of your persona that everybody knows, which is being gay. People come out in all kinds of ways. You came out with an editorial.
Yeah.
That's a little different.
I like to write. Yeah, I came out because I had to. It was just time in my personal life. I write about how I'd sort of kind of been, once I sort of came out to myself, which took longer than I would like to admit, I sort of dragged my feet. I mean, I didn't make it easy on myself, right? My two professional interests were elected office in Indiana and military service, so neither one was terribly gay-friendly. But when I got back from the deployment and I'd reflected a lot on my life and what it amounted to and what it would look like if it ended at a young age, I was a little bit embarrassed about the fact that I was a grown man, mayor of a city, traveled the world, no idea what it's like to be in love. And so I said, I got to come out. So then the question is how? Straight people don't have to come out. And I think it's a little unfair that gay people do. But I get it. I mean, actually, I think by now there are cities in the U.S. where somebody in that situation would have just, I would have just shown up at some event, some chicken dinner, and I'd have a plus one, and it would be a dude, and everybody would figure out what that meant, and we'd just go on our business. But this was the middle of a re-election campaign in 2015 in Indiana where Mike Pence was the governor, and that just wasn't going to work. And so the question was, all right, how do I get this on the table, preferably once, so I can just go about having a life? And so I wrote it up, fired it off, gave it to South Bend Tribune, and the day that it ran, I got a lot of silly questions. And then everybody just kind of got the idea. And we didn't know what the politics of it would be, but the make a long story short, I got reelected with 80% of the vote. So, so I guess the lesson I drew from it is sometimes if you treat people like they are how you hope they'll be, in this case, hoping they would either be supportive or just not care, that's what most people did.
It's easy to say that in retrospect, and you carry yourself with a lot of humility, but you don't do all of this unless you have a lot of ambition. How scared were you that morning when that editorial hit?
It was a little spooky. I mean, it had not been that many years since I assumed it was simply a matter of fact. that you could either be out or you could be in elected office, but you could not be both. And yet, in those same few short years, it had gone from being the case, at least legally, that instead of having to choose between being out and being in the military, you could in fact be both. Still, I gulped pretty hard when I got up. I remember I just went to the basement and started lifting weights. It's not like I was going to sleep well. And then texts started coming in. And one of the first texts to come in was from a friend who's pretty conservative. Mostly because he grew up on a farm and he just gets up ridiculously early. And I realized I was getting texts in order of how early people got up. But some people reached out just to say something supportive. Some people reached out, especially by email. People began writing in to say they were in the same boat. And that meant a lot, knowing that there were high school kids who were better off just because I did that. People in the military. One person I went on missions with who was in the same situation, and I had no idea. And then a lot of other people who found some way to just say hi. I think it was their way of telling me they didn't care. So, yeah, of course it was scary. I mean, I was afraid to come out to my parents, which is strange. I knew that they would be accepting. But I was, my palms were sweating while I'm getting ready to tell my, I'm a grown man. And I think a lot of people have been in that situation. And I know that a lot of people did not get as good an outcome as I did on coming out. And that's one of the things that's got to change.
In talking about running for heading up the Democratic Party, you talk about calling President Trump a draft-dodging chicken hawk, and you say to yourself, that's not me. I don't want to use that kind of language. You're running for a race where this man's going to give you a nickname. Mm. He's going to tweet about
you. What do you suppose it'll be?
He's going to get a... I got some thoughts. I'll share them with you backstage. He's going to punch every opportunity he gets.
Yeah.
You have to have thought... I mean, I think, to be honest, one of the things a person like Kamala Harris gets is she's like, I wish you would, is just the look on her face half the time.
Yeah.
How do you... What's the space you're going to occupy to address that?
So, and this is part of why I talk about having made that comment, which I do regret, not because it isn't true, because it illustrated how he can have a bad effect on his opponents as well as his supporters. Because I don't do name calling. It's not something I normally do. And so I think a lot about how leadership brings out the best or the worst in us. And trying to remember that we've got to be resilient against forces that act not just on the supporters but on the opposition of this president. The most important thing I think we got to remember for 2020 is it's not about him. And it's easy to get into this mindset. Look, every articulate Democrat has fantasized at least once about what you would say if you were on the stage with him, right? He hits you with something and you got that zinger. I got mine too. You know, I would enjoy pointing, but no, I'm not going to do it. And I'll tell you why. It's because when you get into that mode, it is as though he's the one you're trying to impress. And that's how you know you're losing. I believe we need to talk about a world that is going to leave people like him behind. And... you don't ignore what's going on. You don't condone it. When he lies, you got to correct it. When he does something wrong, you got to confront it. But it's not about him. And our whole message in our party in 2016 was about him. And the consequence was a lot of people where I live were saying, okay, nobody's talking about me. And so we have to resist the temptation to make the election about him because he can draw energy and attention of any kind from any source, absorb it, feed off it, and just get that much bigger.
He's made it very clear that he intends to run with the idea that you all are a bunch of socialists. Mm. And when you look at some of the issues, the party does seem to be in a fight for where, how far over does the left go? And I'll tell you about a conversation I had on background with a senator, a Democratic senator, who said, I don't get some of it. He said, some of the stuff we're talking about, free college, my parents suffered to put me through college. Some of the stuff that we're offering, I don't see moderates voting for. How do you limb this? The party wanting to go here, but maybe the country not being there.
So I think that the president's approach is a little bit retro in that it draws on a time in our American political rhetoric when you could kill off an idea by or a person, sometime career, just by calling it socialist. Part of the fascination of the Sanders campaign is the guy who just said he was socialist. I don't even know if he really is in a real sense. I don't even know what it means. I guess that's my point. The word has lost its meaning. I think it began to lose its meaning when the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, a conservative proposal developed at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, first implemented by a Republican governor, came to be characterized by people who didn't like it as socialist. And it was a great example of how the word came to just mean anything they didn't like. And it really skewed a debate where, if you think about it, the right-wing position would be kind of all free market or all corporate. The left-wing position would be some version of national health care, which would mean that the compromise position is a single-payer system where you have private hospitals but public payer. And the compromise upon that compromise, moving further to the right, would be a public option. And something even further to the right of that is what we got, which is ACA. So I don't know, you know, for a generation that did not grow up at a moment when socialism and communism were here and capitalism and democracy were here, and you had to pick one of those pairs, for a generation that is actually very alive to the many ways in which capitalism and democracy have come into tension with each other, and that would ask, when they do come into tension, which do you prioritize, capitalism over democracy or democracy over capitalism? I think that our generation will want to simply know whether an idea is good. So if a moderate senator thinks one of these ideas is a bad idea, they ought to say so, and they ought to say why. But I hope they ought not oppose one of those ideas just because that's what they think the other side will think, because we have psyched ourselves out as a party. And the original sin of this was when we realized, cleverly at the time, that we could win elections instead of going off our values by going off Republican policies and imitating them halfway. And then the entire American debate among Democrats, from the left and the center, was, okay, how far do we go in opposing these conservative ideas, or how far do we go in accommodating them? And the problem with that was our entire dialogue on the American left and center left for the last 20, 30, or even 40 years has really come to be about how we respond to them. They're not keying off their policies off us. They're getting theirs from first principles. Every kid who gets an internship on Capitol Hill gets his copy of Hayek and Friedman, and they know how their conservative ideology relates to conservative values and conservative principles and eventually conservative policies, whereas our policies are just about their policies. So we got to get back to first principles. And I think having a range of people from left to center in this 2020 conversation will be a healthy process for beginning to surface how those things should cash out.
That's a great answer, but when they say, well, who's paying for this, what do you say?
We are. I mean, that's how this works. We pay, and it comes back to us. It's the same as how you get your potholes filled. You pay, and then I pay it back to you in the form of a road that works. I have some views on the distribution of the burden on how people pay for that at a moment when I think most of us understand that some people aren't paying their share. And we could talk about any number of flavors of taxation, from a transactions tax to a wealth tax to adjusting marginal income tax rates to maybe the biggest pot of all, which is just dealing with the offshoring of wealth and profit in this country. And every candidate will come up with some combination of that. But before we do that policy package, I hope we can have a conversation about just what it ought to be like philosophically, so that the policy follows from that instead of the other way around.
Do you feel as though people really take the time to listen to you, to really, I mean, you give dense, thoughtful, packed answers.
Yeah.
We have a president who's like, I'm putting it in 267 characters.
Yeah.
Are people willing to give you the opportunity to really listen, to hear out what you're saying?
I can tweet. Look, I actually think one thing the president probably is right about in terms of political strategy is a lot of it is what happens when you're watching TV and you hit the mute button and you're just getting a sense of how it feels. And that sounds very superficial, and it's a bit sad if you care about the substance. I actually do believe substance matters, but I think style matters a lot. So from a style perspective, I believe in the kind of theory of opposites often associated with David Axelrod, that typically the American people seem to look for the opposite of whatever they just had. I mean, what we got now is definitely the opposite of the president we had before.
You are the opposite of what we have now.
Well, one could argue, following the oldest president ever with the youngest, following a... following whatever he is with whatever I am would be a strong contrast. And so people don't have to be following the blow-by-blow of my views on tax policy to understand I represent a dramatic contrast.
We were talking about this a little bit backstage. You know, everybody hears the resume, went to Harvard, Rhodes Scholar, war vet, McKinsey. People would say, okay, that's a guy who's going to be senator, governor, and then move in that direction. You chose to be mayor. And I think that's something that a lot of people will go, well, why would you do that? And you and I were talking about some commonalities in our background. The people around you exert pressure of that's what you ought to do. How were you able to say, no, that's not it? I'm not going to be Mitch Daniels, go into the administration, and then come back and run for governor.
Yeah. It was hard to, I think there comes a time for most people who want to do something original, especially if you go through this pipeline of you know, gilded resumes, you know, big institutions that speak for you in some way, whether it's Harvard or Oxford or McKinsey or the United States Navy. They're all institutions that somebody kind of figures they can take your measure just by looking at the brand name that you work under. And yet there comes a time for many of us when you've got to leave the warm embrace of that institution to go do something different. And it's a very hard thing to do because the longer you're in any one organization, the more you take on the values of that organization and the culture around you. But what I realized as soon as I left, and like so many people in industrial communities and rural communities, I absorbed this idea that success meant getting out and leaving. And that's exactly what I did as soon as I was old enough. When I was 18, I left for the East Coast and the big city, only to realize gradually that home meant something. More than that, that my greatest sense of purpose was going to come from having something to do with home and the recovery of my home. And that just meant more to me than anything I could get in, well, in client service, for example, where I had this moment where I was working on an intellectually interesting study with good colleagues and being very well compensated to do it, and literally just got up from my spreadsheet and went to get a cup of coffee and thought, I don't care. And the moment that happened, that thought crossed my mind, I realized I couldn't do it for long.
Upstairs, you talked a little bit about foreign policy, and you went in one direction, and about it can't be what was old, it has to be what is new, and it was very hopeful. I don't know that I join you in that moment when I read about, at the Munich conference, people saying, we've given up on you.
Yeah.
This alliance is broken, it can't be repaired. Something I read recently from social scientists say, we are in the moment that this is the beginning of the moment. The Trump moment will last 30 years. It will take us that long to truly spiral out of this, and some of it cannot be undone.
Yeah.
I'm not running for that job. What do you do with that?
Look, running for any office is an act of hope, and you have to believe that things can be better than they are. It is pretty grim. I mean, the positioning of the U.S. in the world right now is not a pretty thing to think about. By the way, this predates, I mean, it's obviously at its worst now, but I remember a moment shortly after President Bush was reelected, and I was overseas at some thrift store. I'd gotten a hold of this Norwegian surplus jacket and a little Norwegian flag on it. And I just thought it was stylish, so I wore it around. And this guy came up to me thinking I was Norwegian, and he was an African immigrant. And he was talking about how his life had gotten so much better when he went to Norway and spent time there, and then he wound up in the UK, thinking, I suppose, that I was Norwegian. And I just thought, oh, that used to be us. That used to be us. And I felt it to some extent, even when I was deployed overseas, and the flag on my shoulder partly kept me safe because there was a sense that it represented a country that kept its word. Even our enemies recognized that we were a country that kept its word. And so the next president and the next president after that will have a lot of work to do to restore American credibility. But I also believe, at risk of talking about things like American greatness that aren't fashionable to talk about on the left, I really believe that American values are more needed than they've ever been. At a moment when the Chinese model is being put forward, in some ways convincingly, as an alternative on how to govern and how to grow, at a moment when Russia is respecting boundaries less and less, to say nothing of what's going on in places from Saudi Arabia to Venezuela. American values matter. Commitment to democracy matters. Commitment to human rights matters. And we need, if we don't do it, it won't happen. Not that we alone can fix it, but that if we don't lead some of these partnerships, but it starts with the understanding that you can either resent the rest of the world or you can lead it, but you cannot do both.
I would imagine you, like many politicians, have something happen to you pretty regularly. It happens to me. People come up and go, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm scared. Hmm. What do the next 2 years look like? What do you tell people in the grocery store when they say that to you?
Usually in the grocery store, they want to talk about potholes. But but I know what you mean. There is this sense of kind of, are we going to be okay? Like, is our country going to be okay? And all I can say is, I'm working on it. And we all are. We all ought to be. If you're not working on it, we need your help.
One of the things you dealt with as mayor was figuring out disparate communities. And you talked about something interesting, that you can't be ready to rake people over the coals when they don't get things right away. That it's a transition.
Yeah.
It's not a switch.
Right.
And also figuring out your way in between communities. In this social media era, there is no chill. You get it wrong, that's it. How do you handle this moment where people are feeling alienated? A poll recently came out where people said they're scared to talk because if they get it wrong, they're going to be told they're the worst ever.
I mean, this is where grace and forgiveness comes in, because we're all going to say something stupid. I mean, we all say something stupid every day. It's just not always recorded. The problem with social media is more often it is, either because we can't resist the impulse to go tweet it out to the world, or because there's somebody around to capture everything you do or say, if in the case of being a visible elected official. So what do we do about it? Hopefully, in the long run, it actually makes us more accepting of innocent foibles, because we've all gone a little too far in a turn of phrase or an expression or messed something up. I don't think that means we should be any more accepting of patterns of harm. That's why I don't think you can just say, oh, well, you know, it was a youthful indiscretion when we're talking about things like active expressions of racism. But I do think there are a lot of ways where we all depend an awful lot on the forbearance and mercy of others. We all do. And so we need to get that back into our discourse. And the only way I know to do it is through leadership that models it.
Where do you think the Democratic Party should be in 2020 on identity politics? There was a time when it was seen as a strength. Now it's become a battleground. Where should they end up?
Well, I think we need to embrace the extent to which we represent groups that have been at a disadvantage for immoral reasons in American history, and recognize that there is a relationship between discrimination in the past and discrimination in the present, and commit ourselves to preventing it from harming our future. I think where it becomes a problem is when identity becomes a source of division, when it becomes a hundred different ways to say you don't know me, when it could be a source of solidarity. I don't know the first thing about what it's like to be a trans woman of color in terms of how I could try to relate that, except that I know what it's like to be an other a little bit. And people want a sense of belonging that I think animates everyone who is feeling excluded from a sense of belonging, whether you are a dreamer who is every bit as American as the rest of us but doesn't have the papers to show it, or whether you're an auto worker wondering in the kind of 60% done phase of your career whether you're going to continue to be able to provide for your family. It's the same thing. And I think we need an inclusive vocabulary that relates the experience of identity groups, not submerging them, not pretending they're not there, but looking at the ways that they could be the basis for solidarity instead of allowing them to be used against us. Because again, I think the biggest forms of identity politics right now are what's being practiced by the White House. And it's also consistent with the strategy, I think, to use race to divide people who have similar economic interests.
Is there anything that you look at Trump and say he got that right? Now he takes a drink of water.
Give me a minute. Well, there is a subliminal premise of his campaign that I actually think he got right and we got wrong. So he said a lot of things that were untrue, like, you know, there's busloads of illegal immigrants voting at your polling place and rigging the vote. So the vote's not legitimate. And similar things about the economy. And we said, no, that's not true. Like, the system's fine. Our democracy's fine. Our economy's fine. And in a certain sense, we were wrong. Elections are totally rigged. Totally rigged. They're not rigged by busloads of illegal immigrants. They're rigged by districts drawn such that politicians get to choose their voters instead of the other way around. Naked, transparent rigging of elections, right? That is lawful, widely known, and obvious. And accepted, somehow. So I think, in a sense, he was more attuned to the dysfunction and the status quo than we were. And part of why we lost, especially in my part of the country, I think, is that we came off as the ones that were saying that everything was fine. And by the way, there is a corresponding temptation that's going to come up in 2020, which is part A and part B. Part A is right. Part A is where we say, what's going on in this White House is exhausting. It's tearing us apart. We can't go on like this. It's exhausting. Leads to this part B that I think is wrong. And the part B is, therefore, let's go back. Let's just go back a little bit to what we were doing before. Let's restore what we had. But I think if what we had weren't letting people down, we'd never have had the problems of which this presidency is a symptom. And that's part of what I mean when I say that we can only look forward.
This is going to be my last question. Then it will be your turn. So start thinking. There'll be microphones in the aisles. Something that you've talked a lot about is there's almost an elitist looking down. These voters voted against their own self-interest. And you can't do that. But I wanted to hear more concretely, what does it mean to talk to somebody in a way that doesn't talk down to them? How do you talk to them and say, this isn't for you? What are they doing wrong? And exactly how do you do it differently?
Well, I think it starts with listening. It helps if you ask people what they care about. Because often what you'll find is that, look, especially if we're trying to think about how to win people over. So there is a segment of that base that we're not going to win over, and we shouldn't want to, right? If you vote the way you vote because you were a committed racist, I'm not interested, and that's your top issue. I'm not interested in your vote. But there are a lot of people who had any number of reasons for voting the way they did. A lot of people where I come from who are under no illusion about the character of this president, but basically voted to burn the house down because they didn't like the system or the alternative. And I do think that when we're reaching out to people like that, we need to do it with a certain measure of regard, even if we're distressed by the choice they made. We need to put them in a position where when they come to our side, they feel good not only about us, but about themselves. So much of politics, the better part of politics, I would argue, is how people feel about themselves. And so if the way we approach them is to inform them that they were complicit in a crime by voting the way they did, or, you know, if a well-heeled coastal liberal comes up to somebody and says, you're voting against your economic interests, you know what they're going to say? So are you. Go away. It starts by trying to figure out what really motivates people to make the political choices they do, because sometimes, just sometimes, it's rooted in some motivation that we can actually relate to. It led them to a different place than it led us, but it's rooted in something that we can account for. And if we can get that dialogue to happen, which starts with the very simple matter of just showing up and campaigning in places that haven't seen a lot from our party in a long time, then the evidence suggests, especially if you look at the 2018 elections, that we can win.
Anybody? I can keep going, but does anybody else have a question? I saw that hand first.
Ms. Edwards, I'd like to thank you for the most wonderful interview.
Oh, here. I'm lucky. I'm lucky. No, I'm lucky. Thank you.
I'm the editor of Drama Around the Globe, and I was intrigued in hearing it coming from Germany. Now I live in America. Many times I think, during the last few years, as if this were Germany in 1933. What I heard tonight made me feel good living in America. So I want you to know that. And I have a question, in addition to the ones that you asked, and that is, If I were a working class person who thought Trump had a lot of good things to say, so I voted for him, I'm not a racist or anything, I'm just, he addresses my issues. I've never heard of you. I barely know where Indiana is, all right? Although I know there's a very wonderful religious person who is the governor there. Okay, so I am that person. What are you going to tell me, coming from a place I've never heard of, South Bend, Indiana? What are you telling me that would make me feel wanted, appreciated, that you heard me?
It's a great question. And the way I want to talk about it is I want you to win in the world that's coming. And the world is changing. And there's no getting the, it's like trying to put the toothpaste back into the tube. It's not going to unchange. But we can make sure it changes in a way where we win. Right now, in South Bend, we have worker union auto workers at a facility that used to make Hummers now making electric vehicles that are made for a company based on Silicon Valley that's funded partly by investment from China. We've had workers making Mercedes R-Class vehicles that only go to the Asian market, so American Union auto workers making German cars in our community that are going to the Chinese market. We're sending our cars to China instead of our jobs. There are ways for us all to win, but we can't pretend that it's possible to turn back the clock. And if we try, we'll hurt ourselves. The future can be scary. But there is a place in it for all of us if we're willing to find some sources of solidarity in these things we care about most, bringing our communities back. And above all, making sure that the future is going to be better, making sure that this generation, that my generation, won't be the first in American history, as we might, if nothing changes, to be worse off economically than our parents. And that means we've got to make some choices together that are just different than the track we're on today.
Hi, Mr. Mayor. My question to you is, what will be different from your campaign versus the campaigns of like President Kennedy and President Obama, because you're, in a way, you've been compared to the last two best presidents, but how do you differentiate from those campaigns into going into 2020? How do you differentiate from that?
Well, it's a flattering comparison. Maybe I should just lean into it. but I do think it'll be different, first of all, in the sense that even though I don't want to talk too much about the current president or the current situation more than we have to, I think this is a response to it, right? Somebody like me, there's a lot of factors that help to explain why probably the only time in American history that a 37-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana would even be slightly taken seriously in a conversation like this. And it means there are some features of this moment that are different, that we are actually at, I believe, the transition between maybe a 40-year era in American politics in the next. And we don't know what the next one will look like. It could be a beautiful time of understanding and modernity working for people. It could be a slide down into a sort of proto-fascism. It could be anything in between those. So this is really about standing at that fork in the road and thinking about where we're headed. I admire both of those presidents, partly because they weren't afraid to talk in thoughtful terms and succeeded at a popular level without trying to dumb down what they had to say. I also think my experience is different just because it's very concrete. Again, that experience of being a mayor, I think, has molded me. And I actually think a lot about executive leadership and what executive leadership in a city of any size has to do with the Oval Office, partly because I recognize the audacity of trying to do this. There's something a little bit almost obscene about anyone thinking they belong in that office, anyone, let alone anybody my age. And yet it is partly because of the relevance of the executive experience of not only forming policy, not only running an administration, but being a walking symbol of a large group of people who is compelled to find ways to bring them together when there are forces trying to pull them apart, that I think shapes my experience. It's just different than if I had cut my teeth in the United States Senate.
Mayor Pete, thank you for being here tonight. I really appreciate being able to hear from you. I have a question about judicial reform.
Yeah.
You know, many progressives, myself included, feel like the Supreme Court has been stolen, from the Gorsuch seat that should have been ours to the controversial Kavanaugh confirmation. And my question is, if you're elected to the presidency and you get into office and you see your agenda being thwarted by a court that has been skewed drastically to the right, for many different reasons, would you support a packing of the courts to expand the Supreme Court by 4 members and restore the Gorsuch seat.
So I've not reached a considered position on the question of court packing, although I don't think we should be laughing at it, because in some ways it's no more a shattering of norms than what's already been done to get the judiciary to where it is today. I will say some of the things I've decided I am prepared to advocate for are in the spirit of acknowledging that bold changes and reforms are needed, not just getting money out of politics, which we got to do, not just redistricting, which we got to do, but things that might require constitutional action, which, interestingly, the court packing would not. Things like questioning whether it really makes sense to have an electoral college that twice in my lifetime has overruled the American people. Asking whether it makes sense to continue to go on with fellow U.S. citizens in places like D.C. and Puerto Rico, denied full political representation. And the reality is you might not be able to end Citizens United without constitutional action. The reason I think it's important to bring things up like this is not just part of it's maybe a Hoosier streak that 50 years ago, my home state senator, Birch Bayh, was authoring several constitutional amendments. The 25th Amendment, which might come in handy one day, the lowering of the voting age, the Equal Rights Amendment, which sadly did not make it but should have. We need to set that as the level of intellectual and policy ambition that we have, which does not come naturally to our party lately. So I haven't reached a considered opinion on that one yet, but I do think very bold, very ambitious ideas deserve a hearing right now.
Mayor Pete, thank you for joining us tonight. I've enjoyed the conversation so far. I have a question around the economy. A lot of people think President Trump is overheating, overjuicing the economy, yeah. And maybe he doesn't want a second term even. So if you get handed this turd of an economy and it explodes,
what really vivid imagery you're giving us here.
How do you deal with that situation where you have a country that may try to blame you as the incoming president?
So the problem of being in charge is that's what's going to happen. People are going to blame you. Hopefully enough good things happen, you get credit for that. You learn this as mayor. You get credit for all the good things that happen, and you get credit blame for all the bad things that happen. Some of them are actually your doing or your fault. Some of them aren't, but you just have to take it. Hopefully you also explain what you're doing and why in a way that is convincing to enough people that you can drive your agenda through and succeed politically. But I am worried about a series of time bombs that have been left in our economy and our society. A fairly short-term one might be what's about to happen to our business cycle. There are, of course, longer-term ones related to the cost of the tax cuts for the wealthiest and the cost of inaction on climate change and a whole number of others that have been set for us that, frankly, are just going to have to be the responsibility of the next president to deal with, even if it's not going to be pretty.
There was another gentleman further in the back. I know, we're going to get some ladies in here.
Okay.
I'm just trying to get the first hands
okay.
that I see.
Thanks for coming to Philly.
Thanks.
So I'm a lifelong right of center Republican conservative, and obviously I'm here because of the man in the White House. And I think the biggest tragedy of his time is not just the credibility of the United States that's hurt, as you pointed out, but it's the credibility of conservatism that he's hurt. And I think this society functions best when we have two healthy parties, two healthy sides. So my question to you is, how do you avoid the temptation that some of the other candidates have taken to say extreme things or to overpromise and to assume that because Trump is so undesirable that everything on the right, everything about conservatism, the real conservatism that he doesn't represent, how does that not be vilified in such a way that turns off enough voters to keep him in office?
Right. No, I think it's really important that we have two healthy parties, that we have robust well-argued conservative position in our debate. And I think the hostile takeover and in many ways destruction of the Republican Party, which is a strange thing to say about a party in power, but I really think the destruction of the Republican Party that's taken place is both a tragedy and maybe a political opportunity for more people to be open to what people on my side of the aisle have been saying. The other side of the coin, though, is I think we need to be careful in assigning the word extreme to a lot of positions that the majority of Americans support, even though it's considered far left to center in, for example, the American Congress. Because I think that's a function of a lot of distortion that's happened in our current political structure. So when you think about something like universal background checks, 80 or 90% of Americans think we ought to do, but is characterized as a far left position and unable to get through Congress. When we think about comprehensive immigration reform, they actually made it through the Senate, only to die in the House in about 2006, I think. When we think about the idea that wages are too low, that there's something wrong with working full-time and not being able to get wages. These are things that are, if we want to talk about where the American people are, emphatically centrist, and yet they're being characterized as far left. I do think that those of us who are interested in proposals like Medicare for All or Green New Deal have a responsibility to show that we're serious about the cost and honest about the cost that they entail. But I also think we're dealing with a moment, if you want to ask why conservatism has been difficult for people in my generation to get on board with, it isn't only the hostile takeover of the Republican Party by the current president. It's also the concreteness of what we've been asked to believe by mainstream conservatives, which was that we should invade Iraq, that deregulating the financial sector would be a good idea, that we should do nothing about climate change that's meaningful, and for some reason, people like me shouldn't be able to get married. And I think that, just as much as the misdeeds of the current president, has undercut the credibility of conservatism, and a modern conservatism is going to think about how to recover from that ideological loss of credibility as well.
Ladies. Okay, let's do one there and then one there.
Hi, we've spoken a lot tonight about domestic policy, but I am deeply concerned about where we're heading as a nation with respect to foreign policy. And past presidents have had their doctrines. We hear about the Bush Doctrine or the Obama Doctrine. So what would be your foreign policy doctrine dealing with all the issues we have from Syria to Iran to China to Israel to Venezuela? What would be your unifying doctrine?
So... Remember that Monty Python thing, summarize Proust? let me give you the core elements that I think ought to be there. First of all, a foundation that every decision, especially any decision that might even be contemplated as possibly justifying the use of force, is rooted in core American interests, number one. Number two, that anything that we do in the name of American interests will be tested first, for its compatibility with American values. Third, anything we try to do in defense of our interests that is concordant with our values, whenever possible, is also vetted with American allies. And then fourth, the Obama proviso, which is don't do stupid stuff. Obviously, that's very reductive. There's a lot that we've got to look at in terms of regional security frameworks that are shifting from the Russian withdrawal from the INF to what's happening in the Middle East to what a future for the Afghanistan-Pakistan region looks like with us out, which I believe not only must happen, but is happening. And the only question is whether we do it well or whether we do it poorly. But I think it will be characterized broadly by, again, a much higher threshold for the commitment of U.S. troops. And at the same time, a belief that we should engage broadly, especially with diplomatic and monetary tools, in ways that harmonize not only U.S. interests, but U.S. values.
Hi, Mayor Pete. So one of the first things that you said tonight was about your Episcopalian faith. And being someone actually from the same faith background, I was actually raised as a Southern Baptist and then decided to become Episcopalian just a few years ago. I'm wondering where you see faith playing a role in the future of the Democratic Party and if we might be able to reclaim the idea of the party of morals from the right and how you see faith playing a role in the future of our party.
Yes, great question. So just as I believe that people on our side of the aisle ought to get back in the business of talking about freedom and talking about security, I think we also need to find a way to talk about faith. We need to be very careful for the reason that it has to be an inclusive conversation, right? That recognizes the equal claim on our politics of people of any faith or people of no faith. And at the same time, I think we should also all be honest about what values propel us when we come to the table. I think that, look, the scripture that I've read says an awful lot about taking care of strangers and immigrants and prisoners and poor people. And faith has been a complicated journey for me, going to a Catholic school that, in many ways, as I write about, gave me some of the values that make me the Democrat that I am, but also that I was, for some obvious reasons, in a lot of tension with. Finding my home in an Episcopalian faith that has really lifted me up. And by the way, there's a lot of meaning to me in the fact that we got married in the church. I think that there is a huge opportunity to connect with others in those terms. But it can't be about, again, there's the articulate Democrats' temptation to use scripture and just beat people over the head with it. I wish in my less Christian moments that I could be on a debate stage with Mike Pence and talk about some of my differences in how scripture might be interpreted than what he seems to have signed on with.
Hi, Mayor Pete. So I have a lot of family that live in Indiana.
Okay.
Actually, Vincennes, from
nice.
A 99-year-old progressive grandmother.
All right.
To my uncle, who's a coal miner and yeah. evangelical coal miner. So my question is this. You alluded a little bit to this. How do you begin to advance your agenda when we have would-be oligarchs wielding dark money in all sorts of ways to advance their interests? How do you rise up from that
yeah.
and combat it?
Look, one of the things that's going to be tested during the lifetime of our generation is how much our system can hold when wealth becomes power. I mean, wealth has always entailed power, but when the deployment of wealth in order to secure political power and often to capture our institutions reaches a breaking point. We came close to that breaking point in the 1890s, same in the 1920s. Both of those were followed by a corrective that largely advanced America's story. Other countries sometimes reach that level of concentration of power and of wealth and cannot deal with it other than by political violence, which has begun to rear its head, right? And we need to make sure that that's not how this chapter of the story goes in our country. I do think that if we cannot remedy the influence of money in politics within the current interpretation of the current Constitution, then we need to entertain the idea of a constitutional amendment to clarify that people should be able to vote more than dollars. And one reason I think we need to be willing to do something that ambitious, knowing that it might take a long time and be a very difficult thing to do, is to have some perspective on what's worth constitutional action in this country. This is a country that changed its constitution so you couldn't drink, and then regretted that and changed the Constitution back. Why wouldn't we change the Constitution to strengthen our democracy when conditions have arisen that the founders could not have anticipated, but in their wisdom established a mechanism for dealing with by amendment? The other thing that I think matters is transparency. So information, the information economy, social media, data, everything that goes with it, has all kinds of harms and pitfalls that are written about every day. It also has the potential to create a greater degree of transparency around how our society is working, and with it a greater degree of accountability on whether our elected officials are best serving the interests of people or whether they're best serving the interests of those who are best able to capture their attention with money.
Mayor Pete, thank you for a great hour.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.